Hello. On this week's program, a conversation with Ted Libby, author of the NPR Listener's Guide to Classical Music. It's one of our thank you gifts in this, our fall fun drive. Jason Pfeiffer examines the role of arts in the criminal justice world as Philadelphia hosts the first Arts and Criminal Justice National Conference this week. We'll hear from conference organizer and mural arts program director Jane Golden. And Susan Lewis takes us through a new exhibition at the Reading Public Museum, exploring the relationship between French Impressionist painter Edgar Degas and the art of Japan. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Broadcaster and writer Ted Libby is best known as the curator of the basic record collection on NPR's classical music magazine show Performance Today. In the early 80s, he was a music critic for the New York Times. He later served as editor of High Fidelity and Musical America magazines. And in 2000, he became classical editor of the monthly Schwann Inside. He's also been a consultant to the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts and Carnegie Hall. Ted Libby is the author of five books, including the NPR Guide to Building a Classical CD Collection and the official history of the National Symphony Orchestra. These days, when not writing them himself, he reviews books for the Washington Post and the Los Angeles Times. His latest work, the NPR Listener's Encyclopedia of Classical Music, gives readers a link to a website constructed by the Naxos record label, where readers can log in and listen to works cited by Libby in his book. This is not your typical website with low-resolution 30-second or 1-minute clips of music. No, the Libby page, or should I say pages, contains full works, some as long as 30 minutes. When Ted Libby came into our studios last year, I first asked him who he thought would be his audience when he began writing this book.
I was writing for the listener. So I was writing for people who listen to music on the radio or to compact discs or their iPods, but people who enjoy listening and want to learn more and to have some doors open to things that might be interested. So for a curious listener, someone who's really enthusiastic about music and may be interested in learning more about it.
At what point did you decide that you wanted to have an oral companion to this? And then how did you negotiate with Naxos that it wouldn't be 30 or 60-second clips?
It was much easier than you make it sound, because it was Naxos that actually proposed this to us when they found out that we were doing the book. Klaus Heyman is someone that I've known for many, many years. And when he found out I was doing this book, it was just at an encounter at a radio conference a few years ago. He said, "We'll do a website." And we started talking about it right then and there. And when we said website, of course, I thought maybe we're talking about this little snippets that would perhaps give people some idea, but not very good idea. No. Whole tracks, which in the case of Naxos means whole pieces.
Wow.
In many cases, or at least entire movements. So we have 527 links currently that stream easily, even on dial-up. It's really amazing. And some of them are 30 minutes long. The entire picture is at an exhibition, 33 minutes. The entire Liszt B minor sonata, 31 minutes. You have movements of Bruckner symphonies, movements of Beethoven symphonies and Brahms and concertos and all the rest of this. It's between 75 and 100 hours of music from the entire breadth of the repertory, from early music, medieval music, all the way up to John Adams' Short Ride in a Fast Machine.
This is really, I mean, Naxos and yourself have really stepped out on a limb here, because I think most of the recording industry is very, very afraid of the idea that if people can hear this stuff for free online on their computer, there's really no incentive for them to go out and buy a CD. What's been the thinking with Naxos? If I can go and hear Mussorgsky pictures at an exhibition, why am I going to buy a Naxos CD to hear exactly the same thing?
I think you might then be tempted to buy a Naxos CD of some other piece by Mussorgsky or some other Russian music. The idea here is you open the door wide enough, and it doesn't mean that people stand out on the sidewalk and look in because the view's great. They're going to walk in, and they're going to roam around, and they're going to look for things. The platforms are changing. The sales of compact discs are no longer going up. But there is certainly still a demand for music, and I think the whole industry is looking around right now and trying to decide, okay, where is this going to come? Where is it going to fall out? Is it going to be digital downloads? Is it going to be some other hard disk of some kind. And until that's decided, it's hard to sort of judge what the trends are. But I think that there will always be a demand. I think that the doing this is not going to discourage that in the least. In fact, when you go onto the site, as you have done, isn't there a temptation once you're there to sort of say, oh,
just click around. Yeah, just find around. Other stuff. And randomly, oh, well, I haven't heard that in a while, or remind yourself. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
You having this tool at your disposal to send the reader to the website to actually encounter the music, did that change your writing style?
It didn't change the writing very much at all. I can explain how that happened. The book was mostly written by the time Klaus and I spoke about this. What we did do, though, was we knew that we would have up to 600 links and that they would be generous. Then it became a matter of choosing. You want to get the maximum use out of a particular link. So if you can use a link to illustrate three or four different things, then that's one to go for. So for the English horn, for instance, mm-hmm. I chose the Largo of Dvorak's New World Symphony. That also gave me a link that I could use in the entry for the piece itself, the New World Symphony, and in the entry for Dvorak. So I got three uses out of that one. That was the kind of thinking we did to select these links very carefully so we get a broad span of music, music from different periods, music of different genres. Then I added text, a sentence here, a sentence there, many, many times. So the result is that people are not just reading through something and they see a little icon that tells them there's a link. We'll tell them something about
what
they're going to hear. So that's what's happened. And so there was a little bit of change in the content, but not in the style.
This is a big brick of a book.
Yeah.
How do I start?
Well, it looks big and daunting, and yet you start by doing just what you have done now. And for the benefit of the listeners, you just opened it to any page.
Mm-hmm.
You just let it fall open. At that point, the workman design takes over, and you see a page that has very interesting illustrations on it, photographs, and you see that there's sidebar material as well that directs readers to recommended recordings, and these are not solely or even primarily Naxos recordings.
Mm-hmm.
These are recommended recordings from the entire catalog of classical recordings, everything that is out there or has been out there. So you open it to any page and you see already visually interesting items. And then it's just a matter of jumping in. There are a lot of cross-references in the book, so that already there are pathways that are created by this book to assist the reader in learning more about a particular idea, a genre, a topic, a period in music, or a particular composer.
Ted Libby. His latest book is the NPR Listener's Guide to Classical Music, one of our ways of saying thank you to you for becoming a member of WRTI during this, our fall fund drive. The first ever Arts and Criminal Justice National Conference comes to a close today in Philadelphia. Hosted by the city's Mural Arts Program, the four-day gathering included panels, seminars, case studies, and field trips, all focused on the intersection of arts, criminal justice, and juvenile crime. As workers in this field continually seek to develop and grow arts and correctional facilities, WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer set out to explore how art is making a difference for those both in and outside of prison.
A good example of art at work in corrections is Philadelphia's Mural Arts Program itself. Started in 1984 as a component of the city's anti-graffiti network, it was designed to eradicate destructive graffiti and address neighborhood blight. Since its inception, the program has included mural making and arts creation as tools for crime prevention and rehabilitation through partnerships with the Philadelphia prison system, juvenile detention centers, and local schools. Jane Golden, director of the Mural Arts Program, says her organization has found success in these initiatives, as have similar programs across the country.
But no one's really talking to each other, so it's a little bit of a silo mentality.
To foster better communication among those in the arts and corrections field and build partnerships, Golden and others organized this week's Arts and Criminal Justice National Conference. Attendees include artists, judges, activists, and prison officials from six different countries. This gathering is built on the idea that incorporating art into the criminal justice system is part of the solution to decrease and even prevent crime, promote public safety, and bring out the best in others. Jane Golden says she often hears people question why they should care whether or not those in prison and juvenile detention centers have access to art.
It costs us too much not to care. In terms of public safety, in the loss of taxpayers' dollars as we endlessly build new facilities, and the loss of human potential. For people who are in prison, who are incarcerated, we need to realize, you know, a very high percentage of people get out. And how do we want people to get out? Do we want them bitter? Do we want them angry? Do we want more crime victims? No, that's not what we want. And if art can be part of a process of getting someone to know themselves better or calming down or feeling good about themselves, or it can connect them with a skill that they can then use when they get out, then we all benefit.
Art in criminal justice comes in many different forms. A mural artist might go into a prison or detention center to help inmates create a mural within the institution or out in the community. Perhaps an author works with a group of offenders to write poetry. A theater director comes in to help prisoners produce a play. According to Grady Hillman, a poet and longtime arts consultant for corrections agencies across the country, one common obstacle to bringing art into the justice system is the perception that the incarcerated are beyond hope of change. He says while this attitude is especially prevalent toward adults, increasingly it's also being projected onto younger offenders.
We're not really worried about rehabilitation or treatment anymore, but we're just going to pass them on to the adult system, and that's just their life for the rest of the time that they're around. They're just going to be stigmatized at the age of 13, 14 as an offender, and we're going to keep them locked up as much as possible, which is incredibly expensive and foolish, too, because there is so much potential for change and for transformation.
My name is Angela Crafton, and I am an artist, art instructor for the Mural Arts Program in Philadelphia.
Nearly a decade ago, Crafton spent a year in the Philadelphia prison system. Homeless and addicted to drugs, she had been living under a bridge in North Philadelphia. After being arrested, processed, and released several times, she was finally put in prison.
I used to always like art when I was young, and when I got older, you know, adolescent years, I just put the pencils and paintbrushes down and got involved in a lifestyle related to drugs and breaking the law, and it wasn't until 28 that I picked up the paintbrush again while I was incarcerated. So when I did that, it changed my life.
The turning point came about through a Temple University prison exchange program called Inside Out, in which 15 Temple students and 15 inmates took a criminal justice class together. Crafton had to draw a picture for a class project, and the resulting support and encouragement helped to inspire a dream of going to art school, which she did once she got out of prison. Now Crafton teaches art to women and juveniles in the Philadelphia prison system, helping them create murals and write poetry. Despite the unpleasant memories of her incarceration, Crafton says she loves going back to prison.
Me working inside a prison keeps me out of prison. You know, it's just something that I think I have to do. This is what I need to do. This is what I was born to do. I got to work with the prison. I got to work with these kids. And if I could just help one or two, I think I've lived well.
This week, Crafton attended the Arts and Criminal Justice Conference in Philadelphia. As the meeting wraps up today, key participants are creating a national coalition to capitalize on the momentum this conference has started. They hope it will lead to a greater exchange of information and help to bring about successive conferences. But this week's proceedings in Philadelphia were not just about expanding the role of art in the criminal justice system for its own sake. As demonstrated by Angela Crafton, it's about helping both offenders and ex-offenders find ways to build a better life through art.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. October is Mural Arts Month in Philadelphia. It's a celebration of the city's extensive outdoor gallery of murals, many of which were created through arts and criminal justice programs. The next dedication of a new mural, one of Abraham Lincoln, is this Tuesday morning at 10 at 723 Ranstead Street in Philadelphia. A new exhibition at the Reading Public Museum compares the work of the 19th century French Impressionist painter Edgar Degas with Japanese woodblock prints of the Ukiyo-e school created the century before. The Japanese influence on Impressionist art is well documented, but as WRTI's Susan Lewis reports, this show makes its case for an even stronger connection between Degas and the art of Japan.
When the Reading Public Museum decided to put on exhibitions that would highlight the strengths of its permanent collection, its three prized works by Edgar Degas came to mind: a painting of a woman ironing, a mixed-media monoprint called The Singer, and a drawing of a woman drying herself. Executive Director Ronald Roth contacted curators Jill Devonier and Richard Kendall, who had organized Degas and the Dance for the Philadelphia Museum of Art in 2002. They, in turn, says Roth, picked up on another strength of the Reading Museum,
which is a very extraordinary collection of Japanese woodblock prints, late 18th century, early 19th century prints of the art movement that was called Yukiyoi, the floating world. These were more common everyday scenes of Japanese life and culture, not historical scenes, great mythological stories, but everyday scenes, for instance, of a woman doing the laundry, or of a woman taking a bath. Also, actors. Kabuki was a big part, and drama and theater was a big part of Japanese floating world art.
Degas, as it turns out, collected works like these, and Kendall and Devonier suggested exploring just how much influence they had on his career. Edgar Degas was born in 1834 in Paris to a French banker father and an American mother. As was traditional for budding artists, he copied work of the great masters and in his late teens received permission to copy work at the Louvre. He studied art at L'École des Beaux-Arts in his early 20s. By his 30s, he was a prominent member of a group of avant-garde artists that included Manet, Cézanne, Renoir, Monet, and Pizarro, whose art was breaking with tradition in various ways. It was the 1860s, says curator Richard Kendall, and Japanese art burst onto the scene.
It was all the rage. People were lining up to buy these prints, and they bought kimonos and porcelain and fans and all kinds of stuff from Japan. They went crazy for Japanese art.
Scholars have known for decades that Japanese art influenced the French Impressionists. Degas, in particular, was seen to have borrowed techniques of composition and perspective. Often images are cropped, depicting only part of a casual scene. Jill Devonier says their research uncovered even more connections.
We also learned that there were many parallels in terms of subject matter that hadn't really been discussed much before.
Perhaps no surprise to women everywhere, one of the common subjects was women doing laundry.
And that's one of the reasons why we're highlighting the comparison between the Reading ironer and the Utamaro washerwoman, because we found that there's a whole genre of laundress imagery in Japanese prints, and that was also one of Degas' favored subjects.
Degas' painting of a woman ironing became, says Executive Director Roth, the root of the show. In it, the figure leans over her work. Her head is partially obscured by a curtain. It hangs side by side with Kitagawa Utamaro's image of a woman washing, a work in which Roth sees striking parallels.
Not only the body language, but this drapery that you see over the head is a really clear echo of what Degas is doing compositionally. And that's really the heart of the show, where we show some of these precedents that Degas saw from Japanese artists and how they influenced composition, color, design, temperament, and feeling of certain portions of Degas' work.
With this start, curators Kendall and Devonier set about finding other Japanese works that mirrored other works by Degas, and vice versa.
It wasn't easy at the very beginning because it's a huge question. Most importantly, we researched the collections of his peers to see, okay, which of his friends had some prints and what kind of prints were they? And once we identified these collections, which were known to Degas, it was easier to find pairings because obviously he knew these images.
Some pairings jumped out at them. Others were more subtle. But this coupling of Degas and Japanese counterparts continues throughout the show, with alcoves in the gallery devoted to different themes. Laundresses, singers and actors, women and leisure, dancers, even landscapes. This layout creates an inherently didactic experience and fits perfectly with the goals of Anne Corso, the Reading Museum's director of lifelong learning.
What we're attempting to do in our educational materials is create that same kind of comparison and interactive looking and looking at the two very different artists and the two very different cultures and examining how they look at perhaps the same theme and how those ideas are conveyed artistically in some similar ways and in some different ways.
There are also sections that explain the art of woodblock printing in Japan and explore Degas' personal fascination with Japanese art. Roth is delighted to have one work in particular that we know Degas enjoyed.
This is a piece by
Kiyonaga, or Toyokini III. And this is very important to the show because this is from the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. It's a bathhouse, and Degas actually had a print of this that was over his bed. It was so important to him in his thinking about art.
There is also a life mask of Tadasa Hayachi, a Japanese dealer with whom Degas became very close, and a delicate painting of two birds created during a dinner party at which Degas watched a demonstration of Japanese painting. Unlike a retrospective of any one artist's work, this show explores and invites connections between two different cultures, separated by continents and decades. The works, side by side, draw us in, daring us to explore the relationships, those that Degas intended, those that the curators saw, and those that we as viewers may yet discover.
WRTI, Susan Lewis. Degas and the Art of Japan is at the Reading Public Museum through December 30th. And that's it for now. Our thanks this week to Alana Emmett and Debbie Fleischman. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.